Good afternoon. You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio, our series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Festival and their Spotlight Health Conference. Each week, we bring you a deep dive into health out of the box, covering a wide range of topics from social justice and caregiving to emerging neuroscience and moonshots.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us on Spotlight Health. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Krista Kay. Today, we talk with Stephen Keating. When a tumor was discovered in Stephen's brain, he wanted to know everything he could about it, even choosing to stay awake during the surgery that removed the mass.
But getting information about his own treatment was much more complicated than he anticipated.
His experience led him to become a patient advocate. He now works on technology that would make medical data more accessible and easier to understand for patients themselves.
We also talk with caregiver advocate Ajahn Poo.
She's the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, advocating for labor protection for nannies, housekeepers, and home healthcare workers.
She's also the co-director of Caring Across Generations. This organization creates and promotes policies that support seniors and people with disabilities and the families and professionals who care for them.
That's today on Spotlight Health. Allison, let me ask you a question. How involved are you in your own medical care? Like, if you go to the doctor, do you ask a lot of questions?
Sometimes. I mean, I think that they're the professional, and so I get a little intimidated. I always default to they're the expert. They know what's going on with me. And after a while, I feel like I'm taking up some of their time.
Yeah, it can feel like you're being a little annoying when you do that when you go to the doctor. But I do think you have to be ready to advocate for yourself. Our first guest, Stephen Keating, went to unbelievable lengths to be involved in his own treatment when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor.
So, Kristen, years ago, I had to get my gallbladder removed, and I asked to keep it. But Stephen went so far as to stay awake during the surgery on his brain.
He was also determined to have access to all of his own medical data. But it turns out our healthcare system isn't really set up to give patients easy access to this kind of information. That got him thinking about how if patients could have that data in a user-friendly way, they might be able to use it to make better informed decisions about their own care.
Stephen's story is so unique, we're just going to let him start at the beginning.
So I've just been one of those curious kids my whole life. You know, the guy, when I was going around asking neighbors when I was 5 and 6 years old if they had any broken VCRs or TVs so I could take them apart. And I was constantly gathering as much data as I could before iPhones could track you. I was taking GPS, tearing it apart, building my own circuits and wearing them on my leg so I could track where I was going. And I was, you know, literally doing all these kind of weird experiments all the time. I was that big nerd in junior high and high school. And when I was in college, I realized that research studies are often looking for participants, and they're so desperate to find participants, they'll often pay people on campus. So if you're ever in wanting to satisfy your curiosity, go to a college and look at the bulletin boards, and there'll usually be dozens of studies looking for participants. And quite often, they will even reimburse you. So instead of, for example, I wanted to see my brain. And so in 2007, there was a study going on with a functional MRI scans looking at the fear response of people. And I think they actually paid me about $20 or $50. I can't exactly remember. But I volunteered for that study because I wanted to see my brain. And I did the study. And afterwards, I asked very nicely if I could see the data. And they let me. And, you know, instead of paying the $5,000 in the States here to get your scan, if you go to a college, quite often they'll pay you and you can see the scan. And you'll help science, which is the most important part of that entire thing. And so anyways, that data, when I saw the data from the scan in 2007, they said, by the way, there's a small abnormality here. We don't know what it is, but you might want to get it checked out. And so I went back to the neurologist for a proper scan to look at this abnormality in 2007. They didn't know what it was. They weren't concerned because I didn't have any symptoms. And they recommended, let's get it checked in a few years, see if it changes. A lot of people have a brain abnormality. It will never affect them. So I went back in 2010, had another scan. It had not changed. They still didn't know what it was. Kind of the end result was just went on with my life because it had no changes and there was no symptoms. So went about my life. I started at MIT, which is always the dream place for any curious kid. And in 2014, I started to smell a very faint vinegar smell for a few seconds a day. And it was kind of, the best way I can describe it is like when you hit your arm and you have that funny tingling sensation. And it's only for a few seconds. It was like that, but a very, very faint vinegar smell. And after about the third day of that, and they would just happen for a few seconds every day, after, no, not at the same time of the day, just random times. And after about the third time that it happened, I was in my bed, it was late at night, and I went to the kitchen. No one was cooking, there's no vinegar out. And I remembered that I had that brain data. So I looked at it and saw the abnormality and Googled around and realized it was near the smell center of the brain, the olfactory center of the brain. And I wasn't sure, I really was skeptical that it was linked at all, but I thought, maybe I can check. So I went to the doctors, the new team in Boston, and presented the situation, and they weren't concerned at all. But I pushed, I asked for another scan, I said, I've got this previous one. And so they booked another scan for a month later because they weren't concerned. And I kind of thought that was great, no big deal. And the smells actually had kind of stopped. And so when I went for the scan, I wasn't feeling super concerned. And I came out of the scan, and usually you don't find out the scan results until the doctor tells you and meets with you. But the technician running the scan said, you cannot leave this hospital. You have a massive brain tumor. And right when I heard that, I had one of those smell symptoms again. I smelled that vinegar. And it was a very, very surreal experience to go through. It was a tumor that was about the size of your fist. It was about 10% of my brain, my frontal left lobe. And I was told that in a few weeks' time, 3 weeks' time, I would have it cut out. And when you're in a situation like that, you kind of gain this new perspective of what really matters. I mean, every time you think you have a deadline or you're stressing out about some small personal issue, it's important to realize what is important. And so for me, when I found out about that, it became quickly apparent that it's, friends and family. That's what matters. In trying to get through the whole process, of course, I wanted to make the best decisions. And so I tried to gather as much data as I could. So I gathered all my clinical data, which is all the medical data in the hospital, but also participated in as many research studies as I could. And I always tried to get access to that research data where possible. And I was even generating my own data, doing things like studying my microbiome, which is poop sampling, if you don't know what that is, genetic poop sampling, before, during, and after chemotherapy to see the effects of the toxicity of the chemotherapy on my stomach bacteria. And I was doing other routes of, sequencing my genome and looking at clinical trials and all these things in terms of trying to figure out what would be the best approach. Because one thing you learn very quickly, which you don't expect until you're in the situation, is that you have to be your own best patient advocate. That there's not an easy roadmap. There's not a clear direction. That many doctors will have different opinions on what's best to do. For example, for chemotherapy for the brain, for me, the UK usually does it for a year, but the US usually does it for 6 months. And there's different types of chemo. And you can choose between x-ray radiation or proton radiation. And different people will recommend different things. And there's a whole host of clinical trials. And a lot of people don't even know to ask about clinical trials because quite often the doctor won't even tell them about clinical trials unless there's clinical trials happening at their hospital. So you very quickly realize that for some reason, the patient is put last in line. And so, for example, when I wanted to access my clinical data, you'd think it would be easy because it's your own personal medical data. And you have a legal right, and this is important for everyone to know, you have a legal right to access all of your clinical medical data. But there's so many small barriers in the way, and when you're in the hospital, the smallest barrier is a mountain. So for example, I wanted to access my clinical data, so I requested it, had to do some paperwork, and then I had to wait in the mail for it to come in a couple weeks, and it came on 20 to 30 CDs. And I don't have a CD reader in my computer, so I, go get an external reader, I upload the 20 to 30 CDs, and now I've got these files, which are very, very complex. And so you've got, for example, a bunch of hundreds of scanned pages of doctor's notes and written explanations of things, but it's unless you're able to sit there and read through these hundreds of pages, there's not much you can do with it. And then there's much more complex forms of data, for example, MRI scans and genetic data and pathology information. And so because there's not an easy way for the patients to use that, there's no tools, the burden is all on the patient to figure it all out. And I was in a really lucky and fortunate position because I was at MIT I had this incredible amount of resources being at MIT and doing my minor in synthetic biology. So the incredible MIT community helped me out and saved my life in many ways. We took all of my data and I put it all online, made it all open. And we sent it out with help from a lot of these MIT professors who helped save my life to all these neurosurgeons around the country and said, you know, who would be the best surgeon for this? What would be the best treatment routes? And I actually ended up changing surgeons based off of the information I received. And I got really lucky that I had an expert neurosurgeon, Dr. Kiyoka, at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, who did the surgery 3 weeks later. And he was very open to supporting me for my collection of data. He even said yes when I asked if the surgery could be videotaped, which he didn't have to at all, but he was very, very kind to do so. And so I had a 10-hour awake brain surgery. And what I mean by awake brain surgery is that I was talking. I was awake while they were cutting open my brain. And it was one of the most surreal moments to go through that and then to watch it afterwards, because I only remembered maybe 20 minutes of that 10-hour surgery. But watching it afterwards and hearing me ask, hearing me talk about my family and friends and asking the doctor how they're doing, while they're holding my brain in their hands is pretty surreal. And for me as a patient, having access to all of that data was not only empowering because I could actually understand my condition, right? I could see what they did. I could understand that, I feel that screw in my skull right now. Here I can see where they put it in, and here's why they put it in, because I could see that it's holding the skull together. But not only the empowering of just having the data, it's useful for me to make decisions. And I can share that data with research studies, which can help further science. And I can share it with supporters. So I would put it online on my website, and then my family and friends could understand what I was going through. And even more than that, this ability to have that data for the future in case something happens is really powerful. So recently I moved from Boston to California, and you'd think that, all the medical data should just transfer between the hospitals, but of course that's not what happens because different hospitals use different communication standards, different data formats. And that's one of the big problems is in trying to make a system where patients can actually access and use the data is that the data is in different standards, different formats in different hospitals, which a lot of times is very problematic for sharing that data or using that data efficiently. So when I moved over here to California, not all of my data transferred. And it was really important that I actually had my own copies of all that data so that when the doctors here in California asked about certain pathology results, I had the full reports already.
The other thing that strikes me is you wouldn't really have gone into the health advocacy, the patient advocacy that you're in, had you not yourself been a patient.
Yeah, and I think this is the most important thing that listeners, if they're listening to this, can do is just when you're at the hospital, ask for your data. It'll take an extra 5 or 10 minutes of paperwork, but even if you never download that CD on your computer, you'll have that CD. And maybe, like for me, if in 7 years from now you have a brain tumor, maybe that data will be useful. And so I think we really want to inform people that this is a problem and there's huge benefits here if we can fix it. And start asking those questions. Start asking, can I download my data and what tools can I use it with? Where can I donate that data to help scientific research? And maybe if you're curious, even go to your local college and see if you can help out the researchers there because they are, I'm sure, in desperate need of participants.
You're listening to Spotlight Health on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. You just heard from patient advocate Stephen Keating. He will be speaking during Aspen Institute's Spotlight Health Conference this summer.
Each week, we talk to leaders in research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health and medicine. Up next on Spotlight Health, Aijen Poo.
She's the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and the co-director of Caring Across Generations.
The NDWA pushes for states to adopt fair working conditions for domestic caregivers, who have historically been left out of labor protections given to other professions.
And Caring Across Generations works to support caregivers, something that will become increasingly important as our nation deals with our rapidly aging population, or what she calls a silver tsunami.
Our first question to Aijen was why the importance of domestic workers can be so easily overlooked.
If you think about it, this work is like some of the most important work in the economy. We call it the work that makes all other work possible. I mean, what could be more important than making sure that our children and our aging parents and our homes are in good hands as we go out to work every day? And still, this workforce is some of the most vulnerable and undervalued work in our entire economy. And I think it has to do with the fact that a few different reasons. One is that this work has historically been associated with women, and in so many ways taken for granted as women's work, just kind of assumed that someone will take care of it and that that person will be a woman, and really just not recognized. And then the other piece of it is that the work as a paid profession has its roots in slavery, the history of slavery in this country, and, you know, has often been women of disenfranchised social status, whether Black women or Native women or immigrant women. So there's all kinds of other forms of kind of social inequality compounding the experience of the workforce. And then there's this long history of exclusion from some of the most basic labor protections. A lot of people don't know this, but in the 1930s, when the New Deal was being sorted out in Congress, Southern members of Congress refused to sign on to the labor law provisions if they included farm workers and domestic workers who were African American at the time. And so many of the basic labor laws that we so take for granted we don't even think about actually exclude domestic workers. So there's a whole bunch of reasons and dynamics that have shaped the shadow and kind of vulnerability of this workforce. And it's a lot, but in the 21st century, this work is only becoming more and more essential, and it's actually some of the fastest growing work in our entire economy. So we've really got to shift that.
It's amazing how much it ties into so many other national conversations right now.
It's true. It's both about how families are changing and how work is changing in the workforce, but also technology and the way that technology is displacing and changing so much of how work happens. And when you look ahead into the future, they're talking about driverless cars and, right, you go to CVS and it's like everything self-checkout now. And when we think about what jobs will remain in the future, many of them will be care jobs.
Have you worked one-on-one with any of these domestic workers, or do you have any stories that help illustrate why they need labor protection?
Sure. One of the first cases I worked on was actually a young woman who is from Jamaica, and two computer technology company executives actually went to Jamaica and recruited her to come and work for them as their live-in nanny. And they promised her mother that she would receive a weekly salary and have the opportunity to go to school, to finish high school in the United States and go to college in the United States, and that they would support that. So at the age of 15, she moved to Texas to live with them and support them in the care of their children, and raised several children for them, and lived there for 15 years. What ended up happening is that the employers cut off all communication with her family, never sent wages home, and never allowed her to go to school. And the only time she was able to leave the house was on Sunday to go to church. So her mobility was restricted, her passport held, and she was essentially enslaved for 15 years of her life until she was able to escape.
For 15 years.
And, you know, and the thing about it is, to keep in mind here, is that in some ways we often compare it to the Wild West, because in some ways you never quite know what you're going to get. And oftentimes you get wonderful families who treat you with the utmost respect and offer a living wage and benefits. You know, that kind of environment exists. And then these modern day slavery, human trafficking cases like the one I just described also happen. And then there's everything in between. And there's very little in the way of standards or guidelines. And the thing about home-based care is that it's very difficult to enforce when there are protections. It's really up to the individual worker to be able to assert her rights and negotiate. And when you are counting on this job to pay the bills and you're essentially working really hard and barely able to make ends meet, there's just a lot of pressure and a lot of vulnerability there. So part of what needs to happen is to really bring this work into the full light of the economy to where people recognize it as a profession and don't treat it as a kind of informal arrangement that kind of happened in the shadows. Because when things happen in the shadows, it kind of breeds shadow behavior. And we want to really bring this profession, which is incredibly valuable, into the full light of the economy so that we can professionalize and stabilize the workforce we're going to need as people live longer and millennials have children and our need for care just continues to grow.
How does this tie into health, and is there something the medical community can do to make the situation better?
Well, this is actually what's interesting. This is where the opportunity is, because if you think about it, the fact that people are living longer is actually a huge blessing, right? Longevity means longer to connect and to learn and contribute and love and teach. I mean, it's longer to do all the things that make life great if we have a plan in place to support people, to be able to live well at different stages of life. And caregiving is a key component to that. A lot of people, 90% of Americans say they want to age in place at home, but we don't have a workforce, a prepared and trained workforce ready to support that. People don't want to be in facilities and in nursing homes. They want to be able to live independently and be with their families and communities. And we need a home care workforce that's sustainable and professional in order to support that. And the upside of that in terms of the positive opportunity for the healthcare community is in the healthcare system today, there's over $1 trillion. I mean, depending on who you ask, up around $1 trillion in waste in the healthcare system. And most of it is concentrated at taking care of the healthcare needs of older adults. And a lot of that waste happens through unnecessary institutionalizations, unnecessary hospitalizations, and also unnecessary institutionalization in terms of nursing home care. A lot of the home care service delivery is, by all accounts, much more efficient and improves quality of life for people so that they can actually live healthier, more independent lives for longer. And so oftentimes what we say is, as we're moving towards a kind of prevention-based healthcare system, what better prevention than good caregiving?
Why is it important that we deal with our aging population as a national level? Because I think it's been put in the laps of individual families.
Yeah. I mean, the reality is that every single day, 10,000 people turn 65 every 8 seconds. That's 4 million people per year. And people are living longer than ever before, so that, you know, the population of people over the age of 85 is actually our fastest growing demographic in the country. So it is something that is going to really change how we think about life in America. And we just haven't really planned for it. I mean, there's so many big questions that are both about the future of our economy, our democracy, and how we live together in this country that are implicated in this demographic shift. And I definitely think this is the thing that people call it a silver tsunami for a reason. I actually don't think of it as a natural disaster. I think of it as a huge opportunity, but we do need a plan. We do need a plan.
Do you lobby or have legislation in mind that would help in these situations?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, We have some incredible news, which is that we had our first big policy breakthrough in the Aloha State last week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The great state of Hawaii actually became the first state in the country to offer a universal care benefit to its citizens, meaning that starting next year, the legislature actually just passed this measure last week, and it is called the Kupuna Caregiver Assistance Program. And basically what it does is it supports families to be able to keep their loved ones at home as they age. And it offers a benefit of up to $70 per day for caregivers to be able to hire a home care worker to provide respite care or take a loved one to the doctor so you don't have to miss work. So it's not everything that people need, but it's a huge help for family caregivers who are juggling their own work and caring for a loved one at home. And we think will be really game-changing for working families in Hawaii, many of which are intergenerational households.
I want to close. There's so much anti-immigrant rhetoric in the country and with our new leadership, and I know that's, like you said, a huge part of this caregiver workforce. How are you reacting to that, and how are you seeing the people you advocate for reacting to that?
Well, you know, the domestic workforce, domestic care work, so nannies, house cleaners, and caregivers, our workforce is the workforce with the highest concentration of undocumented workers of any occupation. And so we are definitely feeling the impact of the attacks on immigrants. And, you know, I mean, I think there's, if you ask anyone, any expert in this field of caregiving or even in the healthcare industry, they will tell you that there's virtually no way that we can care for, that we can meet our caregiving needs as a nation, as the boomers age, without the immigrant workforce. There's no way. So we are absolutely interdependent, and they're going to be a huge part of the solution. And it really is, I think, our collective responsibility to make sure that the threats and the hostility towards the immigrant community stops, because it is harmful to immigrant and non-immigrant families alike, especially when you look at it through the perspective of caregiving.
That was Aijen Pu, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations. She is speaking at this year's Spotlight Health Conference at the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Thanks for joining us on Spotlight Health this afternoon. You can hear this show again and stream past shows online, aspenpublicradio.org. I'm host Allison Bektesh, along with Kristen Kay, who produces this series.
Tune in next week when we talk with Dr. Julian Holt, who researches the effects of loneliness on health and longevity. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Spotlight Health, a partnership with the Aspen Ideas Festival and their Spotlight Health Conference. Join us Tuesdays at 3:30 for conversations with featured speakers from the 2017 festival. Hear from leaders in medical research, patient care, and others on the forefront of health. You can also listen to this series online at aspenpublicradio.org. The 2017 conference runs from June 22nd through 25th. And features four program tracks: the brain, moonshots, intersections, and caregiving. Spotlight Health is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.